You know, when you're a kid, there is this very specific kind of fear when it comes to the dark.
Oh yeah, the absolute terror.
Right. You hit the light switch and you scramble under the covers and you just wait.
Like hoping your ankles don't get grabbed.
Exactly. And it isn't even necessarily about a monster or like the boogeyman. Sometimes the darkness just has a physical weight to it. It feels like an atmospheric dread that just sits in the room with you, hovering near the ceiling long after the bulb goes out.
Yeah, it's a very heavy feeling.
It really is. And decades ago, a little girl felt that exact same heavy, suffocating darkness, but not in her bedroom.
No.
She felt it when her bully shoved her into a cramped school coat closet and locked the door behind her.
Which is just awful.
It is. And that little girl was Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
So today we are doing a deep dive into a truly remarkable essay that traces a line from the trauma of that dark closet all the way to the economic collapse of the American Rust Belt.
It's a fascinating connection.
It really is. The essay is called Dolly's Coat, and it's written by Roger Morrow. He's the editor and publisher of the Beaver County Almanac.
Right.
And just a quick note for our listeners, if you find yourself captivated by this kind of rich regional storytelling, you absolutely need to explore more of his work at beavercountyalmanac.com.
Highly recommend it. Yeah.
So our mission today is to examine how Morrow takes a famous piece of pop culture history and transforms it into this profound meditation on the dignity of the working class
Yeah.
and the quiet power of a single book arriving in the mail.
Yeah, and it is a phenomenal piece of writing, largely because Morrow resists the urge to just write, a celebrity retrospective.
Right. He goes way deeper than that.
Exactly. He takes the origin story of the song Coat of Many Colors, and he uses it as almost like a diagnostic tool.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
What do you mean by diagnostic tool?
Well, he is examining how we process collective trauma. You know how communities survive when they are left behind by shifting industries, and what it actually takes to build resilience when you feel like society has just tossed you in the dark?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Because Morrow actually opens the essay by talking about his own childhood fear of the dark.
He does.
He mentions, with this great dry wit, that he was never afraid of monsters under his bed because that space always seemed too cramped for a monster to efficiently conduct its business.
I love that line.
Me too. It's such a perfect encapsulation of how kids try to apply pragmatic logic to irrational fears.
Right, like a monster needs a proper workspace.
Exactly. But he uses that lingering heavy darkness in his own room to transition to the very tangible darkness young Dolly experienced.
Yeah.
Because the reason her classmates locked her in that closet was entirely about her coat.
Right.
She was small and her family was incredibly poor, and her mother had made her a winter coat entirely out of discarded scraps of cloth.
And what's fascinating here is the psychological layering in this part of the essay is just devastating.
Devastating is the right word.
Morrow focuses on the agonizing contrast between the environment inside Dolly's home and the environment of the schoolyard. Inside the home, those scraps of fabric were handled with immense care. Her mother spent hours sewing them together.
Yeah.
And to give her daughter a sense of pride, she tied the garment to the biblical story of Joseph and his coat of many colors.
Oh, right, the coat of many colors.
Yeah. So she was attempting to construct this psychological armor for her daughter. She was
Ugh.
framing their poverty through a lens of divine favor and deep maternal love.
So she sends her daughter out the door feeling like royalty.
Exactly.
Dolly walks into that schoolyard genuinely believing she's wearing something spectacular.
Right.
But the tragedy is how quickly the outside world punctures that protective bubble.
It's instant.
It is. The other kids, they don't see Joseph. They don't see love. They just see a target. They
Yeah.
see a poor girl in a patchwork rag coat, and they mock her, they rip at the buttons, and then they physically lock her away in the dark.
That's brutal. Yeah.
Think about a time in your own life when a safe internal narrative you held about yourself was just instantly shattered by the judgment of a stranger.
Oof.
That closet isn't just a physical space. It represents the sudden claustrophobic realization of your own marginalization.
Right.
You are trapped by circumstances completely outside your control, whether that's childhood poverty or just the sheer cruelty of your peers.
Well, and the schoolyard effectively stripped away the story of Joseph and replaced it with a stark, undeniable reminder of her economic status.
Right.
That kind of humiliation leaves a permanent mark.
Oh, absolutely.
But Morrow pivots beautifully to how Dolly eventually processed that trauma. She didn't bury it.
No, she didn't.
She transformed it into the song Coat of Many Colors. And the detail Morrow unearths about the creation of that song is it's almost too perfect for fiction.
Right, the receipt.
Yes. She wrote the lyrics about this traumatic, poverty-stricken moment on the back of a dry cleaning receipt for one of Porta Wagoner's custom rhinestone suits.
That is just wild.
I know.
Morrow notes that life occasionally has a sense of humor, which is a massive understatement.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, when I read that detail, a red flag went up for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I struggle a bit with the sheer cognitive dissonance of that image.
How so?
Well, you have someone sitting in a recording studio surrounded by the extreme manufactured wealth of Nashville, wearing thousands of dollars in diamonds and rhinestones, singing a folksy song about a rag coat.
Right.
Doesn't this edge dangerously close to poverty tourism? Like, how does she avoid just exploiting her past for an audience that is comfortably insulated from actual hardship?
See, that is the exact tension Morrow is exploring, and it's a totally valid skepticism.
Okay.
The reason it doesn't cross into exploitation is because Dolly never romanticizes the poverty itself.
I see.
Or she doesn't sing about how noble it is to freeze or to starve. What she validates are the people trapped within that poverty.
That makes sense.
She had lived the reality of the rag coat, and even when she adopted the rhinestones as the uniform of her success, her muse remained fiercely anchored to the working class.
Right.
Morrow points out that she dedicated her entire career to writing about the people who stay where they started.
Stay where they started. That's a great phrase.
It is. She writes for the factory worker, the lonely wife, the illiterate father. She writes for people who wear aprons and punch physical time clocks.
And there is one specific detail Morrow includes here that is just incredibly evocative.
Oh, the grocery store one.
Yes. He says she writes for the people who count their money before heading into the grocery store.
Well, yeah.
Anyone who has ever lived paycheck to paycheck knows the physical anxiety of that moment.
Absolutely.
Sitting in the driver's seat, tallying up crumpled bills and loose change, trying to calculate the exact cost of milk and bread before you walk through those automatic sliding doors.
It's terrifying.
Just to avoid the public humiliation of having a card declined or having to put something back at the register.
It's such a specific gut-wrenching feeling.
It really is.
And that is the exact demographic Dolly champions.
Mm-hmm.
She used her massive platform glittering in rhinestones to look directly at the people counting that grocery money and tell them that economic status has absolutely no bearing on human worth.
Right.
She was broadcasting a message to everyone wearing their own version of a patchwork coat, proving that their experiences were worthy of art.
Which perfectly sets up the transition to the primary focus of the Beaver County Almanac.
Yes.
Because Morrow takes this universal theme of validating the working class and he plants it deep in the soil of Western Pennsylvania.
Right.
Here's where it gets really interesting. He argues that Beaver County ought to understand Dolly Parton better than almost anyone because that region knows exactly what it feels like to be remembered only when someone needs something from you.
Oh, man. Yeah. And to understand why that resonates so deeply, we have to look at the historical and psychological mechanics of the region.
Okay, let's get into it.
For generations, Beaver County was the industrial powerhouse of the area. It was defined by steel mills, heavy smoke, and nonstop river traffic.
Right.
Morrow paints this vivid picture of men coming home after a shift with so much grease and dirt embedded in their clothes that it made the washing machine look discouraged.
I love that line, the discouraged washing machine.
So good. The labor was backbreaking and filthy.
But it provided a foundation.
It provided an identity.
Exactly.
But then the mills vanished. And Morrow highlights that when an anchor industry abandons a region, the economic fallout is only half the tragedy.
Right.
The psychological fallout is much worse. When those mills closed, they didn't just take the steady paychecks. They took the confident assumption that the next generation would have it better.
Yes, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, that phrase is crucial. The fundamental promise of the American working class has always been generational progress.
Right.
You endure the discouraged washing machine so your kids can go to college.
Exactly.
When deindustrialization hits, it doesn't just eliminate jobs, it erases the future. Mm-hmm. It breeds a very specific kind of generational despair.
Yeah.
And this is compounded by geographical proximity because Beaver County sits right next to Pittsburgh.
Right.
Morrow calls this proximity both a blessing and a little insulting. And it's insulting because while Pittsburgh successfully transitioned its economy, you know, moving from steel to high-tech, robotics, elite healthcare, and higher education, Beaver County was largely left behind to rust.
Yeah, just completely bypassed.
It became a place people just drove through on the highway to get to a booming metropolis.
Right.
The region was essentially told by the modern economy to sit quietly and be grateful for whatever scraps of industry or funding happened to fall off Pittsburgh's table.
Yeah.
And the connection Morrow makes here is incredibly sharp. Beaver County is the coat.
Yes.
The entire region was economically shoved into a dark closet, laughed at by the shifting tides of global commerce, and handed a pile of literal and metaphorical scraps.
It's such a powerful analogy. But Morrow doesn't let the region wallow in victimhood.
No, he doesn't.
He writes, "So we know something about scraps. We also know something about sewing them together."
Wow.
And that is the psychological pivot of the essay. It marks the transition from passive suffering to active agency.
Right.
Acknowledging that you only have scraps left is painful. But picking up the needle to sew them together requires a profound amount of intention.
It really does.
It requires a community deciding that their fragmented pieces still hold inherent value.
And that conceptual bridge between Dolly's philosophy and Beaver County's reality becomes tangible in 2024.
Yes, it does.
Because Dolly Parton actually arrived in Beaver County. Now, Morrow mentions that she had played Pittsburgh enough times over the decades for locals to drive down for a concert and still get home before the babysitter charged overtime.
Which is such a funny, very real detail.
Yeah, it's great. But her recent arrival wasn't on a tour bus. She arrived through the Dolly Parton Imagination Library.
Right. And for listeners who might not be familiar with the mechanics of the program, the Imagination Library sends a free, high-quality, age-appropriate book in the mail every single month to enrolled children.
From the day they are born until they enter kindergarten, right?
Exactly.
And Morrow zeroes in on the administrative rules of this program, and it's where his writing truly shines.
Yeah, he points out some great stuff here.
He points out two massive distinctions. First, there is no complicated application process.
Thank goodness.
Right. He describes typical bureaucratic forms as being designed by somebody who has never filled one out while holding a baby.
That is so true.
If you've ever tried to navigate a government assistance website while a toddler is screaming in your ear, you feel that line in your bones.
Absolutely.
But the second distinction is even more important. There is no income test.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
The absence of an income test is arguably the most radical and effective component of the entire initiative.
I really want to pull on this thread.
Okay.
Because in a place like Beaver County, a region that has suffered systemic economic decline, why not target the resources?
Right.
Why not ensure that the books are only going to the families who are hovering below the poverty line?
It seems like that would be the standard approach.
Yeah. Sending free books to a family that can easily afford to buy them on Amazon seems counterintuitive to traditional philanthropy.
It does seem counterintuitive until you understand the psychology of poverty, which Dolly understands implicitly.
Okay, tell me more about that.
When you introduce means testing, when you force a family to provide tax returns or pay stubs to prove they are poor enough to deserve a free book, you are recreating the exact dynamic of that coat closet.
Oh, wow. I didn't think about it like that.
Yeah. You are forcing them to perform their poverty for a bureaucracy. You are yanking on their buttons and reminding them of their marginalization.
Right.
By making the program entirely universal, Dolly removes the stigma of charity.
Yeah.
The book isn't a handout for the poor kid on the block. It's a gift for every child in the county. It completely bypasses the bureaucracy of shame and delivers literature wrapped in dignity.
The bureaucracy of shame. That's a powerful way to frame it. So the lack of an income test isn't an administrative oversight. It's a deliberate psychological shield.
Exactly.
And the origin of the program itself reinforces that focus on dignity.
Yeah, it does.
Morrow reminds us that Dolly didn't start the Imagination Library for good PR. She started it in honor of her father, Robert Lee Parton.
Right.
She frequently referred to him as the smartest man she ever knew, yet he was completely illiterate.
Which is heartbreaking.
It is. He couldn't read or write his own name. But before he passed away, he told her that this book program was the most important thing she had ever done.
And Morrow makes the compelling case that this endorsement from her father is the only metric of success that actually matters.
Absolutely.
And what I appreciate about Morrow's analysis here is his refusal to indulge in sentimentality.
Yeah, he keeps it very grounded.
He states very clearly that there is no cinematic moment attached to this program.
Right.
When that book arrives in the mail, poverty doesn't suddenly evaporate.
Right.
The local mill doesn't magically reopen. There are no swelling orchestral soundtracks or politicians cutting ribbons.
It's just a postal worker walking up to a porch and dropping a package in a mailbox.
Yeah.
The child opens it, and for 20 minutes, their world expands. It's an incredibly quiet, incremental form of change. And Mara argues that in many ways, that quiet expansion is enough to start turning the tide.
And this raises an important question, and it brings us to the broader societal critique embedded in the essay.
Okay.
Morrow observes that we have a cultural habit of polishing away inconvenient truths, especially when we are trying to canonize someone.
Like Dolly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We want to smooth over the rough, gritty edges of Dolly's background, just like we want to smooth over the harsh realities of deindustrialized Rust Belt towns.
Right.
But Dolly actively resists that polish. She knows firsthand that abstract optimism does not pay the winter heating bill.
So what does this all mean? This leads to what I think is the most devastatingly accurate political observation in the piece.
Oh, the part about public policy.
Yes. Mara writes that Dolly knows personal determination has often been unfairly asked to do the work of public policy.
I highlighted that exact sentence.
I mean, let that sink in. Society loves the narrative of the rugged individual pulling themselves up by their bootstraps because it completely absolves us of our systemic failures.
Right. It shifts the blame.
Exactly. We tell the families in Beaver County to just work harder, to just have more grit, rather than confronting the disastrous trade policies or corporate greed that gutted their communities in the first place.
Yeah. So unfair.
Dolly's philanthropy is brilliant precisely because it doesn't wait for public policy to fix itself.
She just acts.
Right. It sidesteps the broken machine entirely and puts a physical book directly into the hands of a child.
It is a radical act of reframing value.
It is.
The overarching thesis Morrow extracts from Dolly's life and applies to his home county is that a child can be materially poor without ever feeling fundamentally worthless.
Right.
A coat made entirely from discarded scraps can actually be a thing of profound beauty, but only because a mother fiercely refused to believe those scraps are garbage.
And to bring this all together, Morrow draws a brilliant contrast between the two coats mentioned in the essay.
Oh yeah, this part is so good.
You have the biblical Joseph. He receives a coat of many colors that symbolizes his father's supreme favor.
Right.
But look at the mechanics of that story. That favor immediately breeds jealousy, resulting in betrayal, violence, and a long, brutal story where he is sold into slavery.
That's a dark story.
It is. Then you have Dolly. She receives a coat that symbolizes nothing but a mother's desperate, fierce love.
Yeah.
It results in immediate cruelty and laughter from her peers, but Dolly rewrites the ending.
She does. She refused to accept the narrative the schoolyard tried to force on her.
Right.
She didn't burn the coat. She didn't bury the memory. She kept the stitches. She kept the colors. And she used them to fuel a lifelong career dedicated to the very people society treats like scraps.
Yeah.
Her art insists that those discarded pieces are worth the effort of sewing back together.
And that beautiful realization brings us full circle to the very beginning of Morrow's essay.
The childhood fear.
Yes. That lingering childhood fear of the dark pressing down from the ceiling.
Right.
Morrow concludes the piece by admitting he still sleeps better with a light on. But the nature of that light has fundamentally changed.
Exactly. The light keeping the darkness at bay isn't a 60-watt bulb on a nightstand anymore.
No, it's not.
It is the literal books arriving in the mailboxes of Beaver County.
Wow.
Every time a child in that post-industrial landscape opens a new book, they are pushing back against the generational economic darkness that settled over the region when the heavy industry left.
Yeah.
The darkness is finally quietly giving way to the light.
It is a breathtaking piece of synthesis and observation.
Truly.
Once again, all credit goes to Roger Morrow, the editor and publisher of the Beaver County Almanac, for providing such an incredible source text.
We can't praise it enough.
No, we can't. If you want to engage with regional journalism that treats the working class with this level of nuance and respect, head over to beavercountyalmanac.com and read Dolly's Coat. You will not regret it.
It really is a masterclass in empathy and observation.
It is.
And as we finish our deep dive today, I want to leave our listeners with one final unwritten thread to pull from Morrow's work.
Okay, let's hear it.
Take a moment to think about your own life or the town you grew up in. When we look at the places or even the parts of ourselves that have been left behind, broken down, or marginalized, we almost always fixate on the scraps.
We do.
We obsess over the industries, we lost the opportunities, we missed the funding we never received.
Yeah.
But what if the true measure of our worth isn't found in the quality of the fabric we are initially handed?
Oh, I like that.
What if our actual value is determined by the strength of the thread we use to bind our communities back together? Take a look around. What scraps in your own world are just waiting for you to pick up the needle?